It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When the coronavirus began to spread, there was a lot of fear that Pennsylvania hospitals wouldn't have the resources to keep up. Lucky for all of us, that hasn't been the case. But the facilities and systems themselves have taken a pretty significant financial hit. Andy Carter is the president and CEO of the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania. Andy, your organization advocates and lobbies for 240 hospitals across the state. How is the financial impact different, say, on large systems, including UPMC and Allegheny Health Network here in the Pittsburgh area, compared to community and rural hospitals?
Well, Kevin, thank you. I'd have to tell you whether you are a large hospital, a large healthcare system, or a small 25-bed critical access hospital, you are facing staggering challenges to your ability to remain a strong and sustainable healthcare entity. And the fact that hospitals have cooperated with public health authorities to suspend scheduled procedures to make room for the expected surge of patients has taken just a big cut out of their revenues, and they've also incurred huge costs acquiring new equipment and getting ready for the number of beds that would be available.
Right.
So huge burden for regardless of your size.
Are there specific challenges unique to, say, rural facilities?
Well, there are. Our rural hospitals are going into this entire episode with pretty significant financial strains because of reductions in population and a struggle even to recruit the physicians and nurses that you need to provide high-quality health care. And so layer on top of those challenges that have been in place for some time, the COVID pandemic, and you face a very significant risk of potential closure. So we need to be very vigilant and support these small hospitals that are particularly vulnerable in our rural communities.
So what does it mean to be cash-strapped right now for a hospital? What services or supports won't be there?
Well, hospitals are taking steps to preserve cash. And we need, though, to provide support because there is no way to resume normal operations in light of these significant losses without some help.
What created this problem? You alluded to the scheduled surgery holdup, the pause. Is that it? Is that the main source of revenue that's no longer there?
That's exactly right. Hospitals depend significantly on scheduled surgical procedures, diagnostic procedures, and also outpatient visits. And all of those have essentially dried up. And because they account for 50, 60, in some cases, 80% of margin for these facilities. So when you lose all those more, we'll use the term profitable services, the ability to continue serving the community broadly with emergency care, behavioral health services, and others are significantly compromised.
Is there a worst case scenario of facilities actually closing or maybe a reduction of services, what's offered, or even staffing reductions?
Absolutely. There is a significant risk of closure. We started 2020 with about a third of hospitals operating in the red. So if you were hit with this pandemic and had to cancel all of these services and you were already in the red, your long-term sustainability is very much in question. Even if you weren't operating in the red, chances are that you were operating with a razor-thin margin. And that likely will lead, without support, to reduction of service levels for those that can survive. But the chances of surviving without significant modification and staff reductions is pretty limited.
You are lobbying the Wolf administration and the legislature for support. How much money are we talking about? And specifically, what do you want that money for?
Well, we're asking for a couple of things. One is to relieve hospitals of the obligation to pay a $500 million provider tax. Secondly, we're asking for creation of a coronavirus emergency response fund, estimated to be at about $2.5 billion, which would support not only hospitals and health systems, but also physicians, health centers, skilled nursing facilities, and other healthcare providers who are at the front line and have experienced substantial financial harm as a result of this pandemic.
Why go to the state? In April, the state's tax revenues were $2.2 billion below their projections. Why do you expect the state to help when it's struggling to meet its own budget?
Well, the federal government is sending this $4 billion pool of funds to the Commonwealth precisely to help it cover COVID-19 related costs. And we're just asking that healthcare be at the front of our priorities.
Hospitals already get personal protective equipment from the state and the feds. Are you working as a group of hospitals to acquire more?
We're working together collaboratively across all the hospitals and nursing facilities and other healthcare providers in two ways. One, if there is a dramatic need for more personal protective equipment in one part of the state and there's an excess supply in another part, we play a role under contract with the Department of Health to shift those supplies to where they're most needed. Secondly, we're all working together with the business community to help connect manufacturers, distributors of this kind of equipment to where it's needed. It's tremendous to see that competitors in the healthcare space are working so collaboratively together during a crisis.
Do you think that this cooperation will continue after things go back to normal or something close to normal?
Yes, I do. One of the many lessons we're all learning in this crisis is that we have to establish better systems to move these kinds of resources around during a crisis. Within individual markets, hospitals will compete, and that's good for patients, while in the background, collaborative efforts to be ready for the next pandemic or even the resurgence of COVID-19. Take place.
Andy Carter is the president and CEO of the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Kevin.
I'm Kevin Gavin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. There's been a dearth of art on Pittsburgh's stage and screen this spring that Point Park University's Pittsburgh Playhouse thinks they can help fill. Stephen Breeze is the artistic director and dean of the school's Conservatory of Performing Arts. He's with me from afar to talk about a new pandemic-inspired series for the upcoming season. Stephen, what are you looking for from this new play reading series?
The play reading series was an effort to bring new plays and new ideas that are in development to the Playhouse to work with our students and faculty and staff and guest artists to bring new work into being in an exciting and a way in which would be helpful to the playwright as well as educational for our students. But when the pandemic came upon us, we realized that we had a rare opportunity to ask playwrights who were maybe thinking about this already to bring a new play or new plays into being that might surround or use the pandemic and the global crisis as a jumping off point, a springboard, if you will, for a new idea and a new way to interpret the world or to, you know, reflect the way human nature is responding to this crisis. When you look at moments in the past, like the Great Depression and the Dust Bowl, and you see those great playwrights that came up, Steinbeck and Odets and Richard Nash, you know, plays like Waiting for Lefty, Of Mice and Men, The Rainmaker, these plays were really born of the crisis of the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. And the same thing if you look at the AIDS crisis, that plays like The Normal Heart and Angels in America used as a backdrop for really discussing some important issues. And we think that this particular pandemic may also be a springboard.
And as the name might suggest, it's a play reading series. So how will it be performed? How can people tune in, or will they be able to see it in person?
Well, best of all possible worlds, if we're up and running and fully operational in the fall, they will be performed on our stages, and people can come and listen to the readings and discuss it afterwards. Those details will be on our website. The rehearsal process is short because it is a reading, but the students and the guest artists that will be working on these readings will be a polished reading. It will certainly feel a bit like a performance, but we are soliciting work that have never been done in front of an audience. So the thrust isn't for a performance that would be polished. The thrust is for a reading that would help us understand what this play could become. And that's an exciting time to be involved with a play, is when it's still in its formative states. And the playwright will be present, and the professional director and the actors will be there for discussion after each one of the plays. And I think it should be a unique opportunity for audiences to be able to experience this. Now, if we are not fully on ground and operational, then we'll probably be doing this differently. Perhaps we will be doing via a Zoom or some other platform. But the plan right now is to hopefully be doing it live.
And submissions will be accepted between June 1st and July 1st. So what do you imagine could come from such a prompt? You know, talking about the pandemic, there's all these different arenas. Are you picturing dramas, musicals, comedies? What do you think could happen?
Well, we're anxious to find out what will happen. Playwrights tend to look at the world around them. They tend to observe what they see and interpret it in new and interesting ways. So it could be a musical, it could be a drama. I would imagine that we will get all sorts of treatments. I think particularly, though, people right now are feeling new things based on the isolation and loss of community and global fear of sorts. And I think that the playwrights that will tap into these ideas will come up with ways to see the world that are new and different and I think could be, you know, fascinating for an audience.
You know, historically, it seems like pandemics, things like this, have been relatively underrepresented, right, in art compared to war or other, I guess, more visible natural disasters. What do you think that might be unique to the stage, or in this case, the reading, that maybe we haven't seen before? What would excite you most?
Personal stories with a global perspective is probably what is most exciting to me. You know, in the last, you know, significant pandemic, the 1918 so-called Spanish flu, that pandemic was just devastating. And even though it was a global pandemic, we did not live in a global culture. Now we live in a global culture. And so I think that what's going to happen is that playwrights will tell personal stories, but with a global perspective. And I think that's exciting.
Stephen Breeze is the Artistic Director and Dean of Point Park University's Conservatory of Performing Arts. We'll have a link to the play reading series and ways to submit on our website at WESA.FM. Stephen, thanks so much for your time.
It's great to be here.
I'm Megan Harris.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Childcare is an essential component of reopening the state. Centers can now operate in the 24 northwestern counties that have moved into phase yellow of the governor's plan. Allegheny County and 12 others will follow on Friday. Many centers will limit capacity. WESA's Sarah Schneider reports on the challenges that come with running a childcare business during a pandemic.
Amy Nordstrom is nervous about reopening her childcare center, Little Wonders, in Erie, that she has owned for 20 years. She wants to bring her staff back to work, but she has asthma and is concerned about getting sick. She says parents are worried about their kids being in a group setting.
Yeah, I've had a couple that have voiced that they were scared, that, you know, anytime their child gets like a runny nose right now, they're very scared.
Daycares are high-touch areas with shared toys, hugs, and lots of germs. Nordstrom has spent the last few weeks preparing to run her business differently. She spent hundreds of dollars on cleaning supplies to sanitize those toys. She purchased touchless soap dispensers and masks, all of which were hard to find. She plans to take temperatures at child drop-offs. Still, it won't be perfect.
Kids are going to be kids. Things are going to be unavoidable. You know, it's just going to be a lot of learning.
Pennsylvania's Office of Child Development and Early Learning wants child care providers to follow the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's guidelines. It calls for fewer kids in a room, lower overall capacity, and child-to-teacher ratios. The CDC wants kids over two to wear masks. But those are just guidelines. The state hasn't set formal restrictions for centers that are reopening. Department of Human Services Secretary Teresa Miller says decisions about masking and social distancing will be left up to providers.
I actually think that guidance is pretty good and pretty helpful in helping providers think through how to do things differently.
Gwen Marcus runs the Project Destiny Child Care Center on the north side of Pittsburgh. Her center is one of the 1,500 in the state that remained open with a waiver to care for children of essential workers, while 80% of Allegheny County centers are closed. Marcus says she now spends much of her day cleaning. When children are finished playing with a toy, they put it on a designated table for her to sanitize.
So it's constant cleaning. I've never cleaned so many Legos and boxes in my life.
She cut classroom capacity in half. The 10 children in the center do not wear masks, but teachers are trying to keep kids apart. She says the key word there is trying. The staff constantly remind kids that they can't share toys, and they have to play separately because of the virus. Every child has their own set of markers and crayons. Marcus says the priority has shifted from early learning lessons to keeping everyone healthy.
It's like you took all my years of training and said, okay, forget all that. Let's redo everything.
Trust will likely determine the future of these centers because parents are hesitant to send their kids back. For example, KinderCare, a national organization, didn't open its centers in western Pennsylvania with a waiver because too few parents said they needed care, as many are working from home or have been laid off. DHS Secretary Miller says the shutdown could mean centers that already operated on slim margins won't reopen.
I do worry that, we have families that are not going to be able to go back to work because they can't find anywhere to put their children.
She says if the state decides to spend federal stimulus funding on childcare centers, it will be helpful, but it won't cover needs.
We obviously have a major budget problem right now. We don't have revenues coming in, and this is going to be an issue for a while.
Kara Simonello is the director of Trying Together, an early learning advocacy group in Pittsburgh. She says how the economy reopens will have a lot to do with how childcare funding is prioritized.
Childcare really is an essential sector, and we've got to be thinking about that infrastructure as important as we think about bridges and streets and utilities and hospitals.
She says state and federal governments must see childcare as a crucial part of economic recovery. I'm Sarah Schneider, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of the show on our website at wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joya Zenkovic, Kylie Kozinski, and Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Please be safe, and I hope you have a good day of good news.